And now it is my pleasure to introduce our main speaker for the evening. Please give a warm welcome to Rich N.
I'm Rich Nicolosi. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Rich.
Like that haircut?
Yeah.
I like the price. You know, my sponsor told me to wear a coat and tie, and then it's so hot up here when he's up here, he tells me to take my coat off. I can't win. You know, I do what I'm supposed to do. I don't do what I'm supposed to do. I mean, I get a break.
Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks. What would I do without you? You know, you know what? If you're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and you're looking for the answer to your financial problems, this isn't the place. This is the cheapest bunch of people you'll probably ever meet in your entire life. Also, if you're coming here to find a girlfriend or a boyfriend or both, whatever you're into, this isn't the place. If you're looking for relationship advice, you want to start a business, you're having problems with your kids, you have no friends and you're just kind of lame and want some place to hang out, you know, actually that happens a lot. This is not the place. This is about not drinking. There's lots of other programs that deal with drugs, that deal with, like Maria was talking about, well, those overeaters, they're crazy. What are you supposed to do, not eat? I don't get it. You know, I'm not eating one day at a time. I know it's a little different than that. And I apologize to anyone who may be in the program. I'm sorry, but I don't get that. You know, the AA has been such a huge blessing in my life. I just want to warn you right off the bat that I did some drugs, too. Just once, from 1984 to about 1997. I used them alcoholically. My favorite was fantasy. Anything that will just get me out of me. You know, I was born here in San Diego. My sobriety date is January 20th, 1998. I have 11 and a half years sober. I have a sponsor. His name's Cruz. He's sitting right over there. Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest gift that I've ever received. And I look at Alcoholics Anonymous as a gift. I am like any other alcoholic that's in this room. At times, I think I got it figured out. I got it going on. Look at me. Look what I've done. And I get humbled to a state of reasonableness. And I absolutely just am trying to get myself to stop doing that. If I could only figure that out, that's why I have a sponsor. That's why I check in. I also have some guys that I sponsor that are coming up on long-term sobriety. I have one guy that's got about 10 years. And the one thing about sponsoring, and Joe, one thing about sponsoring guys that have time is that, you know, you really can't pull anything over on them either. Because, especially the guys that I got. I was born in San Diego, greatest place on earth. You know, where else better for an alcoholic or someone who abuses drugs than to grow up 15 minutes from Mexico? The beach is here. You want to go to the desert. Hollywood's just a couple hours away. I mean, we got it all, baby. I love this place. My parents are strangely, they're here tonight. First time they've ever probably heard me share. And so I can't really lie, damn it, about much. My parents are two great people, and they're here tonight, so I can't blame them for my alcoholism. You know, for a lot of years, I thought it was because, you know, you hear all the psycho babble. You know, my dad was in the yard throwing the ball with me every day, and, you know, my mom was in the medical field, and she was kind of like, if you were homesick, she'd be taking your pulse, have a stethoscope on you, looking in your eyes. No, you're going to school. Yeah, that's how she was. And my mom was very tough, and I love her to death. My dad's here, too. They're two wonderful people. They're two well-adjusted human beings, and they just freak me out. You know? They go to work, they pay their bills, they're nice people. I don't get it. I can't blame it on them. I hear so many times in here, people come and talk about their childhood, whether it was good and bad, and mine was great. We lived in a nice house. My dad liked, BMWs and Porsches and all that kind of good stuff. And when I was growing up, I grew up on some really nice cars. And my family had some turmoil, had some problems when I was growing up for a little while there. And I never went without clothes. I never went without a nice house to live in. I never went without my parents being there. My sister's here tonight too. We never went without. And that was some of how I would try to sell it to all the buddies. Man, I'm having hard times. And blame it on all these conditions in life. I don't know if any of you have worked that step number 4. It talks about conditions. If only the conditions would change around me, then things would be okay. When all this changes, I'll be okay. And I grew up much of my life focused on, if only the conditions would change, then I'll be okay. When this happens, then I'll be okay. When I get her, when I get this money, when I get this job, when I get this car, I'll be okay. And I live my life that way. So, played sports. It's pretty good. Loved everything. I started my first drink. I can vividly remember. One thing I wanted to say to you about my parents is that they're both working very hard to support us. And they're both working jobs. And I had a lot of free time. And what I would do is that I would steal liquor out of the cabinet and drink. And the first time I ever drank, I had an older, kind of really cute babysitter. We all drank, and she kissed me. I was like, man, this is it, baby. Woo! I thought I'd arrived. I felt great. I had older women picking up on me. I was 9, I was like, woo! And that liquor cabinet would call my name. Funny story is that my parents had some friends over about 20 years later, and they went to pour them a drink, and it was 20-year-old apple juice. Hey, I didn't want to get caught, That's how much of drinkers my parents were. I had some neighbors that they used to do those other things, and we wanted to be able to drink for quite a long time throughout the night, and it was a little easier to stay up drinking if we had some other things that would keep us awake. We started doing other things, and like my friend Jay back there, some people just lose the ability to, do drugs like normal people. I can't do drugs like normal people either. I use them alcoholically. And what I found is that when I went to parties, and I had the stuff, I had a lot of friends. People liked me. They wanted to hang out. I was like, this is pretty cool. So me and my cousin would get more stuff, and we had more friends, and more people would like us, and it was pretty cool, and, I was able to kind of buy things the other kids couldn't, and, my family was kind of going through some hard times, and, I liked a lot of stuff, and, that's how I got the stuff that I wanted. I would always do the same thing in my life. I don't know if any of you guys, anybody here can relate to this. Because I could always kind of pull it together enough to get everybody off my back. You do? It's not just me. I could always pull it together, man. I could look good on the outside, and I could get everything in order, kind of arrange everything. And then it would all fall apart, man. And I do the same thing. I start getting sneaky. I start sneaking away. I start lying. I start making up things, and I'm a great liar. I could sit here and have a conversation with you about my career as a professional golfer. How I was on the tour, and I could just roll with it. I was given that gift, I guess you could say. Sad thing for me is that, I played sports and I was good, and I remember at football practice one time, I was played ball for just a little while there, and I was doing really good, and I thought maybe this is going to be my thing, And I was just knocking people out. It was just great. And a buddy of mine said, hey, you want to go get a beer instead of go to practice? Said, yeah. Anybody relate to that? Everything going just great. All of a sudden somebody says, let's go get a drink. And I was just, everything was going on. And I couldn't figure out how once again I let everything go. That simple, that fast. And I was baffled. Totally baffled. So I figured I kind of had to get a job by this time, I worked for my dad for a while. He fired me. What his problem was. I wasn't working. wasn't doing anything, lying to him, stealing from him, you know, all that kind of good stuff. Model employee. So I decided, you know, my dad bought me a drum set when I was about 12 years old, and that was pretty good. And I remember when I was really going to do the whole, I was going to be, my whole thing is I wanted to be something other than just part of society. I had to be something better because I felt so bad inside that I had to elevate myself so much higher than the rest of you so I could hang out with you. That's me. So I started playing in this little band, and I brought home this crazy drum set I bought off a guy that was a drug dealer. He spent like $15,000 on it and tried to play it for 2 days. Couldn't play it. Sold it to me for like $2,500. I was like, woo! Came home, set it up. My dad walks in the room and goes, wow, I guess you're serious. Yeah. This band I was in, we put out a couple CDs, toured. I got to do the whole rock star thing, you know, for a little while. And man, I had arrived. Here we go. I've got that thing, you know. We played Lollapalooza. I mean, and third stage. But, you know, we played Lollapalooza, and we were hanging out with rock stars, and, you know, it was incredible, man. I had arrived, and then there came that night where I had a little too much to drink and did a little too many outside issues, and next thing I know, I got the guitar player up against the wall, and I'm just wailing on him. They really didn't want me to play with them anymore. I couldn't understand it. So there it goes again. After that, I got a job with a beer company. Everybody's going, yeah, baby. In the midst of this, I'm as Alcoholics Anonymous, and I show a lot of respect for this program, is that I'm doing a lot of drugs at this time. A lot. And I'm not talking about, you know, just smoking a little pot once in a while. I'm doing a lot of drugs. And I'll try to reel under control, and it'll get out of control, and I'll get fired from a job, and I'll reel it under control. And I got this job with Carl Strauss Breweries. Oh, man, that was sweet. They were just taking their beer, and they were starting to sell it out to bars and restaurants. And we made beer. I'm an alcoholic. We make beer. I mean, I still think about it. And I'm like, man, that was great. You know, they do the things like the middle of the day where they go, hey, we just finished some beer off. Let's go taste it. You know, twist my arm. I became the draft beer manager, like most of you. I'm sure you guys can understand. It seems like most alcoholics were pretty sharp, you know, most of us are pretty sharp. And I rose to the ranks and did really well. And I had a keg on tap at my house in Point Loma. Me and my roommates were growing a bunch of outside issues, and we were just making a ton of money. And I had a keg on tap at my house. My sister probably remembers. I had a keg on tap at my house. I'd have the driver come by every week and check my keg and make sure it was full. And man, I had a lot of friends. There was always people over at my house. We were really popular. You know, and I couldn't just be friends with somebody. I had to lure them in with all this outside stuff. Hey, check out all this stuff I got. Come over and drink off our keg. Hey, look at my car. Check out our house in Point Loma. You know, that's me. I could never just be okay with myself. And I pursued that to the gates of insanity, you know, and death. Like Maria said, I've had an out-of-body experience. I've been dead before. I'll get to that in a minute. I didn't die, in case you're wondering. Sharp group. So that didn't work out. I got fired. They were kind of pissed off. What happened is that they brewed some special beer for an occasion. They had some Germans coming into town, and I took a couple kegs and was having a party at my house and have the owner of the company call me up and be like, where's the brown ale? I'm like, oh. They were kind of pissed. And, of course, I thought it was because I was out selling everybody. You know, I think it was probably their piss that I took their beer. But anyways, I got fired again. And after that, I was like, you know what? I'm not working anymore. You know, I'm tired of this crap. And I went full time. Yeah, I don't want to work. Me? I'm like a rock star. Woo. So I decided to delve a little deeper into the outside issues. And I really liked sleeping till 1 o'clock and playing pool till 2 in the morning. And, you know, I lived the life, you know. And I want to make sure also that to keep another buddy of mine happy from Friday night is I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun, Jay. I had so much fun that I could not stop. And what happened to me is that I could not stop drinking. As hard as I would try, to reel this thing in. And no matter how bad things could get, I could not stop myself. I would say things like this, if any of you can relate. Okay, I'm just going to have 7. Can we do that? I'm just going to have 7. And I would hear other people say strange stuff to me like, I better stop, I have to go to work in the morning. You know, or, oh, hey, I'm starting to feel it, I better slow down. Or my favorite, I better stop, I have to drive. That's when I start going, oh yeah, baby, that's more for me. You know, I was the guy at 1:30, it was, well, we got to go to the store now. They close at 2 a.m. And no matter where we were, I geographically knew how long it would take, and I'd be like 1:26. We're killing time here. I knew where we were and where we had to get more. I delved into this life, man. It was just crazy. I ended up, you know, I went to jail. I did some prison time. All this kind of, you know, really cool macho stuff. And I ended up going to Philly for a little while. And I would call my mom and tell her everything's okay. And she knew everything wasn't. And I'd ask her to send money because I was such a big-time, you know, drug dealer and all kinds of stuff. Mom, you send me some money? You know. I was out in Philly for a while. And I took a hostage with my first wife. Came back to San Diego. And went through a rehab, and then I got out, and the thing you should do about 60 days is get married, you know? So I got married, and then I dragged her through. She liked the thug that I was, and I ended up diving a lot deeper into a lot of other things, and I would do things that you wouldn't want to see on TV. I had no mercy. I felt no pain. I could do anything to anyone and not ever feel bad about it, and that's what I did, and I was really good at it. And I did that for a long time. And I could not get enough booze and drugs in my body to make it stop, to make the memory stop, to make the vision stop. I couldn't make it stop. All I could do was drink more. This guy's going, yeah, I know what you mean. I could always, no, some guy behind me. You know, all I could do was drink more and to put more in my body to try to squash the stuff going on in my head. And what happened is, eventually down this long story that I'm already telling, on December 22nd of 1997, I drank probably, a couple fifths of Jim Beam, which is my favorite, and decided to shoot a speedball before I went home. You know? I walked into the door of my house that I lived in at the time, and I fell flat on my face, and my wife at the time called 911, and they narked me, and it shut my respiratory system down. I was dead on arrival at Mercy Hospital. Kind of missing. Yeah. And there was no like light at the end of the tunnel. There was like no angels or anything like that going on. It was kind of like it was dead silence. The strange thing about it is that the guy kept smashing my tongue between my teeth, putting the breather on me, and I was trying to punch him in the throat, which is my favorite move, letting y'all know. Which is my, you know, I wanted just to punch him in the throat, and I couldn't move, and I saw everything that was going on at the time, and it was the wildest thing I've ever experienced. That did not stop me from using the drink. You think it would? I woke up in that hospital bed to see my parents. I'm sure you were there at some time, my sister, and my wife at the time. And my first thought in my mind when I came out of that was, oh, man. How am I going to get loaded? They're here. I'm in this bed. I can't remember if I was. I think I was handcuffed too. Was I handcuffed? I can't remember if I was or not. And I'm going like, how do I get out of here and how do I get loaded? Well, and this doctor's talking about this bag of pills that I had. I'm like, oh, I need that. And he, no, you don't. I'm like, I need this, you know. And so I went home and had a horrible Christmas. You know, I never had any presents for anybody. I never thought about anybody else. I didn't care. At that point, alcohol, drugs had become my master. It was my lover. It was my best friend. It was my everything. I didn't care about anybody or anything else except how I was going to get loaded. And I would walk over you. I'll rip you off. I will lie to you. I would trample you to get to what I wanted. And I didn't care. I was that tornado it talks about in the book that threw everybody's life that loved me. As soon as I would get a couple days sober, 30 days, just like the guy, I'd go, gee, Mom, isn't it great the wind stopped blowing? You look behind you and the house is leveled. Well, what happened is a couple days later, a buddy of mine dropped off a 12-pack before New Year's and a couple joints. You know, it's what good friends do when you just die from an overdose, right? Thanks, buddy. So I remember drinking that night and having what we like to call a moment of clarity. I couldn't get drunk. I couldn't get loaded enough. and I saw myself for what I was. And I have to back up for 1 second, because this is the point a couple years prior that I realized that I had a serious problem, is that I was such a big-time guy that I was living at home with my parents, and my sister was asleep, and I was lifting 20 bucks out of her purse, and she woke up and her eyes locked onto my eyes, and I looked at her, and she tried to grab it back from me, and I looked at her, and we tugged at it, and I looked at her and I said, "I need this." And she said, "What have you become?" That moment right then, I knew something was really wrong. I knew that I had a problem. She let go. That's how I knew. And it took so much booze and drugs to squash that when you know what you are and what you've become. I knew what I was and what I'd become. And by the time I got to that point, I could not get enough in my body to stop the memories, the thoughts. And I just asked for help. My ex-wife at the time, my wife at the time, ex-wife now, had moved out. I was in a home, the power was getting shut off. And I called, "What do you do when you're a big-time guy?" "Call mom and dad." So I actually started interviewing at this rehabilitation place for community resources and self-help. And they wanted you to be sober and clean 3 weeks before you went in there. So I lied. I didn't know until I'd taken cakes. Well, my sobriety date was January 1st. And you guys noticed my sobriety is January 20th. I took cakes on January 1st for 9 years. Unbeknownst to me, that my brother-in-law, when I saw him, my sister and him are no longer together, but I saw my brother-in-law picking up my kids one day. He goes, "Are you still clean and sober?" I was like, "Yeah, dude, almost 10 years. He goes, "I remember we smoked a joint the night before you went into rehab." And I was like... I've been taking tokens 3 weeks early for 9 years. So on my 10th year... I'll get into that in a minute. That was funny. I went to this program, and I walked in the door there, and I had done time, and I was mean. I was just... Larry remembers how mean I was. He talks about it often. Larry was the only guy that could handle me at the time. I was just big and mean and pissed off, and I have special warfare trained. I know all kinds of crazy stuff that I can't even pronounce right now. And, you know, I can really do some damage when I get going. I went to this program, and this little woman, about 5'2", little white lady with glasses, walks up to me, looks me in the eyes, and she goes, "You don't have the balls to stay sober." And I was like, "What?" So I stayed sober for 6 months just to prove her wrong. My mom knows how stubborn I am. You tell me I can't do something, boy, I'm going to do it 10 times over, maybe 11. She looked me right in the eyes, and then I was graced by, I told Larry I'm going to mention his name to make sure he shows up early. And I'll say your name, whether you like it or not, Larry, because I love you to death, man. You know, Larry Dixon was a guy who was there, and there was 3 guys in the house. We were all trying to be shot callers. We were all trying to run the show there, and we were all big dudes, and we were all mean, and all done time, blah, 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 you know. We were all whoop, 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 and hey, dog, and all that kind of funny crap, you know, how we talked. Funny story about that, too, is that my dad visited me at a rehab one time. And I was like, you know, talking to whoop, 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 and hey, dog, and all that. My dad goes, what happened to you? And I was like, wow, why am I talking like that? Trying to be cool. Anyways, Larry pulled me aside, and I was about just to go big on these guys. And this is how tough I am. I was probably ready to walk out and leave. And Larry pulled me aside, and he said, "Rich, what are you doing, man?" You know, and I was like, "What?" And he's in my face. I'm going like, "He's this little black dude. You know, I'm just going to go, I'm going to crush you." And I was affiliated with All Things You Are, and When You Do Time, and the people of my type didn't hang out with people of color. We didn't like people that were gay. We didn't like anybody that wasn't like us. And I had this little black man in my face. And I'm going like, "What in the hell is this? I'm going to crush this guy." You know? And he was so intense in my face. He's like, "I'm going to take you to a meeting where there's warriors." I was like, "Oh yeah? Cool. Hell yeah! You know? That's what I am, you know?" So we went to a meeting called La Mesa Men's, which is my home group. And right now, like, these jokers, are you kidding me? I'd stayed sober for about 6 months, and you know, I was in this rehabilitation place. And at 6 months, you know, you kind of work your way up. So I'm like one of the top guys in the house, you know. I got 6 months sober, you know, I'm thinking I'm bad, you know. Woo! That's a long time. I remember sitting in a meeting, and a guy took a 90-day chip, and I was like, in a row? Ha, right. 90 days? Larry took me to this meeting, and there was a guy there named Hugh McCoy. And Hugh had 55, you know Hugh? Hugh had 55 years sober. And I was going like, in a row? You know? And these guys were having a good time. And they were laughing. And they were busting on each other constantly. And I'm going like, I think I can do this. You know, I'm looking for the warriors. I'm walking in, I think there's a bunch of guys that are just cut up and bad, you know. Tattooed and mean. All right, you know. I go in there, I'm like, that's a Jay. What? No, I'm just kidding. I love Jay to death. I bust his balls as much as I possibly can. There's guys like Jay who intimidated me there because they had experience. They talked this lingo, you know, keep coming back. I have to look at myself. I'm sharing my experience. You know, and this language was foreign to me. They were talking about these steps, you know. And I'd been in a rehab where you follow their program, haven't worked any steps. And Larry dragged me to that meeting. My buddy Phil, which I love Phil to death, he's one of my best friends now. Phil picked me up, and he had about a year sober. He had a brand new car, and I hated Phil's guts for 2 years. New car, looked good, had the family, and I was. So I went through this place called Crash, and I got out of there a little bit after 11 months because I was so well. I was there for 11 months, and I was one of the top guys in the house, and, you know, you're in one of those facilities, and you're thinking you're all this. And then you go to meetings, and you hear guys are 55 years sober, you know. I still thought I was pretty hot. But I hadn't worked steps yet. I had taken a couple. One thing I did do is I conceded to my innermost self that I had a problem, that I was alcoholic, that I needed help. That's one thing I did do 100% at that time because I never got loaded again after that point. That's one thing we have to do perfectly. You have to concede to your innermost self. You have to be willing to ask for help. You have to know that you cannot do this thing on your own. You have to rely on a power greater than yourself. And then you have to be willing to allow that power to come into your life. I've had those first three steps. And I'm a year sober. I'm in Logan Heights looking for a Mexican guy. And I couldn't find one. What the hell? You got a Mexican in Logan Heights in the afternoon? I was so pissed. You know? That is weird, because I was going to get loaded, I was determined, and I knew where the guy hung out. I went back to the sober living that I transferred into, and I crawled up in my bunk and I cried like a baby. And I called Larry, and he was like, you want to write that four step? Okay, man. So I wrote that four step. And Larry came and picked me up, and we went to the place where everybody does fifth steps, Marie Colliner's. And it wasn't the one we all go to on Friday, it was the other one. That's Larry, man. That's the place. So I wrote out all this stuff, man, and I go, man, when he hears this, whew, and he is going to freak out, you know? Because I've done some crazy shit, you know? And Larry's like, uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm telling him all my stuff, and Larry's heard it, and he's been there, man. And Larry knew how to handle me, you know? Not many people can. Larry knew how to handle me. We did my fifth step there, and I told him everything. I didn't leave any stones unturned. I told him some stuff that I'm still a little paranoid today that I may go to prison for the rest of my life. And we're burning my four step outside of Marie Colliner's as a cop car drives by. I mean, Larry's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, oh, I'm making sure you're like. So we did that. I went home, did my sixth step, and did the seventh step prayer. And I called Larry, and he said, take out a pen and just write E-G-O on every one of those pages. I said, what are you trying to say? You know, my first, they say, this guy up here earlier saying, getting sober is the easy part. or the hard part. Stain silver is the easy part. Man, that's a tough call. I'm not going to really give my opinion on that. Other than, I've had some tough times being sober. What I found out that I had was I had an obsession of the mind, which tells me that I may be able to drink beer. You know, all this new beer that's out? Mike's Hard Lemonade, never had it. All, you know, Smirnoff Ice? Maybe it'll be different. I don't know. These kids are doing all this weird stuff called OxyContin, and, you know, never done that one. Maybe it'd be different. That's where my mind goes. And I tell the guys I sponsor that, you know, occasionally I drive down the freeway and they have that Heineken sign where the bottle's just sweating, and I go, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to be for the rest of my life. This isn't one of those things where you just say this magic prayer, you jump up and down, you do, you know, two snaps, you say these words, you do a magic handshake, and you're cured for life, man. This is a willingness that you have to turn, that I have to turn over to God every day. Larry had a bunch of stuff going on in his life at the time, man, and I was dying. And I thought that maybe if I changed sponsors, it would fix me, you know. I love Larry to death, and he knows that, and I got another sponsor. Found out he's kind of saying the same shit. Same stuff, excuse me. What the hell? You know? And I learned some... Without Larry and Brenda, I wouldn't be standing here today. There's those people that cross your life, that come across your life at times, and you know that if they weren't in your life at those particular moments, there's no way I'd be standing here. I know it to the bottom of my heart. Every time I take a cake, I thank Larry, because if he wasn't there, I wouldn't be here. Jeff had a great saying. Jeff would always say, okay, buddy, what other people say, do, and think is none of your effing business. And I'd go, because it was always about how you acted or what they said or, you know, Jeff's favorite saying. He would always tell me, you can do anything you want. I'd go, yeah. He said, but you have to be willing to pick up the tab. That's the part I didn't like. I was really fortunate to have a very good first, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. Let me back up for 1 second. Up until about 3 years. This is what it was like the first 3 years being sober. So I would go to a meeting, and I'd come home, and my ex-wife would be like this. So how's the meeting? And I'd be like, so you can't even do that? No. And she would leave bottles out and all this kind of stuff. And it was pretty rough the first couple of years. And as soon as that relationship went away, I had injured my back at work. We were selling a house that we just built, and I was getting divorced. And I had a little back injury, and they wanted to give me all these narcotics, and I didn't take them. God, I wanted to so bad. And I remember at that time, I was rolling with Cruz and a bunch of guys that were newly sober. There was about 8 or 9 of us, and we went everywhere together the summer of 2001. We went to meetings every day. We called each other every day. We hung out every day. We played all kinds of tricks on each other every day. We were just, like, out of control. And we all stayed sober over the summer. And Cruz took off to Italy. And a bunch of guys, he was a sponsor, and just kind of, they just said, well, you be my new sponsor now? I'm like, oh, God, you know. 3 years sober, suddenly I have, like, 5 or 6 guys. And make a long story long, at that point again where I'm sitting in my house and I just want to die. I don't know why, but that feeling, I don't know if any of you can relate. I just don't want to live anymore. And I don't want to drink. And I remember several times when I was doing my thing, waking up with the hammer on my gun cocked and an empty bottle laying next to me. I wake up and go, whoa, thank God I got drunk. Again, I was at that point where I was going, like, I'm just going to end it all. I can't take it anymore. And I had a back injury, and I'm crawling to the closet, so I'm going to do it this time. And I have a sponsee call up on the phone. What do I do if somebody's mean to me at a meeting? Shoot him? Like, can't you see him trying to blow my brains out here? You know, God. Rude little bastard. That moment, something rained. It rang clear in my head that by helping these other guys,
Something like in the foreword of the second edition says vigorous work with others. Well, nothing will ensure immunity like rigorous work with others. All those kinds of themes started to come into play. And I started to sponsor guys. And I started to be of service. I was a pig. I'm a lazy pig. I want everything. I don't want to do anything for it. Right? And I was like that way in Alcoholics Anonymous my first few years. I just took and I took. And as I started to give, I started to feel that madness, that insanity in my head started to quiet down a little bit. And I started to allow God to come into my life. And I could never say God because I thought it was weird. You know? I'm going to say God. I don't want to be that guy. And he goes to the meeting and talks about God. And everybody goes, oh yeah. And you know what? God is the center of my entire life today. That was the moment when I realized how important it was for me to get off my dead ass and start giving this thing away. And when I started to do that, my life began to change. I started to feel a new freedom. You know, I started to really start to make those amends. You know those ones that you put off a little bit? You're like, I'm not miserable, but I'm just a little bitter, but I'm kind of okay with that. I don't want to... Well, the 8th step says we made amends to all persons we had harmed. It doesn't say just the ones we want to or the ones that are convenient. And I began making amends to people. I'm a slow learner. And I started helping people. I started sponsoring guys. And that's when my life began to change. And I met my next victim, my second wife. She lied 3 years. She had 77 days. I mean, isn't that a perfect match? I did the usual thing. Want to go to coffee? I can fix you. She's still sober 8 years now. But, I wouldn't recommend that. I have two beautiful children that I'm really grateful for. And I was really doing well then. I was so focused on making money that I stopped going to meetings. Like what Maria was talking about. I had a great career, and I thought that if I bought enough stuff, it would fix me. And I started buying houses and duplexes and dune buggies and travel trailers and, you know, custom choppers. And on my birthday, I had my parents over, and I opened up the garage, I'm like, yeah, look at my chopper. My dad's like, yeah. I couldn't buy enough stuff to fill the void. And if you're new and you hear us talking about that, there's no mystery why people go out and get loaded. There's absolutely no mystery to this program. Okay? As soon as I stop doing all the things that connect me to God, we get loaded. My great friend, Ben, you know, 18 and a half years, asked what happened. Stop going to meetings. Stop calling sponsors. Stop taking steps. It's the same thing for all of us. It's the same set of ingredients that Larry showed me 11 years ago. Now, over time, staying sober, the ingredients kind of changed just a little bit. And what I thought was that, you know what? I can skip out on Friday night. I really don't need to go. You know, I got all this stuff. Well, my pride and ego and greed got the best of me. And I took everything I had and I put it into a business. Because I had this humongous 10,000 square foot shop. And look at me and look what I've done. And finally I've arrived and now I'm okay. And what I also learned was anything you put in between you and God, I guarantee you'll lose or throw away. And I went into a business that never made a dime. I'm not talking about profit. I'm talking about I didn't make a dime since the day we opened it. And it was this huge ego trip for me. And I held on as long as I could, and I poured every dime we had into it. And, you know, things happen. Luckily for me, I built a career before then. At the same time, I'm not going to talk about anybody else's part in this other than mine. I got divorced. And again, miserable. Miserable. I love seeing guys around 4 to 7 years. Because we think that in that 4 to 7 year period, that AA will fall apart unless we fix it. Any guys ever recognize that? Anybody there right now? I got guys coming to my Friday night meeting that are telling us that have been there for 20 years how to do it. You know, I got guys at 3 or 4 years chastising us on how we're doing it wrong. And I love it, man. I love it. Like, yeah, baby. That's when I really got into Alcoholics Anonymous. Those 4 to 7 years, as soon as I hit about 8, I stopped doing all that stuff. And I started doing all the ego-tripping stuff. And, you know, I threw away everything. And
It was ego-deflating. Pride and greed had gotten the best of me. And God had humbled me to a sense of reasonableness again. Strange thing happened to me. I got to a point again and then blew it all. In recovery. How does that happen? Well, I realized that old saying that we heard is, what happens when you sober up a drunken horse thief? You still got a horse thief, right? I wasn't working on the horse thief part. And the strangest thing happened again. I started sponsoring a bunch of guys. I get busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. My life begins to change. You know, things are not where I would dream they would be. But I can honestly say right now that life for me, looking at myself in the mirror, is the best that it's ever been. Not because I have all the stuff and the stuff in the driveway that says it's okay. It's because I can look at myself in the mirror at 2 o'clock in the morning and I don't want to die. I don't want to drink. I've been able to pass this along to a few guys that have maintained some long-time sobriety. I don't say that because I think I've kept them sober. Because I've got to watch them grow. I've got to watch guys like Joe, who came in just beat up. Work on himself. And I mention Joe all the time because when I was going through so much stuff, I don't know who sponsors who with Joe sometimes. I'll run stuff by him. I see a lot of guys out there that sponsor guys, and they treat them like little pukes. You sit in your seat and shut up, and all that kind of stuff. I don't do that, man. Nowhere in the book does it say that. Nowhere in the book does it say you treat people like that. It says our new friend, our new prospect. It says love and tolerance is our code. You know, and as bad as I want to intimidate people with fear and get my way, every time I do that, and those defects run my life, I wind up in misery and I wind up in pain. And the ingredients for me are sponsoring a bunch of guys, going to a bunch of meetings. And one thing I learned specifically this last year, and I'm about to shut up here, is in being in service to God doesn't mean that I'm in service to just alcoholics. I think a lot of us have that wrong. I think that we're just of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're missing the boat. I think it talks about being in service to God, which means that I practice these principles in all my affairs. When I'm at work and somebody does something I don't like, I'm going to rip them apart and then go to a meeting and talk about how happy and joyous I am. No. One of my guys was sponsoring another guy that was going through, one of my grand sponsors, great grand sponsors, was sponsoring a guy that was wanting to kill himself. You know? What we do, we rally around this guy. We help people. I have a good friend of mine who's a devout Christian. Devout Christian. And him and I talk about God, and I love talking to him about God. I am not a Christian. But him and I have these incredible conversations about God and about spirituality, about how growing, how we can help other people, about how it's not about my ego, it's not about me satisfying all of my instincts. It's about what I can do to help my fellow man. And I can say that today. I used to say it 4 or 5 years ago. It's about me helping other people. And you go, yeah. Never internalized it. I know for a fact that by me helping other people, I get to stay sober. It's the greatest gift I've ever gotten. And it's the greatest gift I've ever been able to give to another human being, is to take some guys to the steps and listen to their fifth step. You know, the same way Larry listened to mine. Okay, come on. Same thing again, pride, lust, greed. Come on. That's me, I'm a loving, caring guy. I'm going to leave you guys with this, and then I'm going to sit down and shut up. You know, I got some good news and bad news for you. The good news is, if you're an alcoholic, if anything I've said makes any sense and you need help, there's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. You can come and you can get the help you need. And the bad news is, we're your new friends.